This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up on today's show, we visit with News Director Dave Thompson about the week's biggest headlines, and Matt O'Lean reviews the new biopic, Rocket Man, about Sir Elton John. But first, we start with our favorite philosopher, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs this coming Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. The weather's warm. The sun is out. Winter is history for at least another couple weeks.
Yay.
I couldn't be in a better mood.
Well, good segue, because we are going to talk about wellness, and there is a happiness component to health. And so the episode is, what does wellness mean, and how do we get there? And your guest is John Rady. He is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard and the author of a number of books, including Go Wild. Jack, how did you find this guy?
Well, actually, my therapist told me about him. There's a book, his second book, it's called Spark, and it's the connection between exercise and the brain. And one of the things it talks about is the way that exercise helps manage depression and stress and anxiety and a whole host of other things. And 6-7 years ago, my then therapist suggested that I read it, and it blew my mind, and it changed my way of thinking about the world, and it really helped me just manage a whole host of issues that I felt like I lost control about. And it took me a while to get John on the show, but I'm super glad I did. In fact, it took me long enough that he had this next book out called Go Wild, and so we got to talk about that as well.
And when you have a title like What Does Wellness Mean and How Do We Get There, let's include a definition here. What do you mean, or what does Professor Rady mean by the word wellness?
Well, I phrase the question that way because we're used to talking about health. And when we talk about health, we talk about medicine, we talk about blood pressure, we talk about sort of narrow biological view of what it means to be a human being.
That we look at in isolation.
That's right. Some people will use the term reductionist, right? It's a really narrow view of what the human life is. But wellness is a term that's in the culture now, and it's much more holistic. So it talks about attitude. It talks about mindfulness. You can not only talk about diet, but you can talk about yoga. You can talk about social interaction. You can talk about the happiness and the joy you feel in your relationship. You can talk about the work-life balance that you have. Wellness opens up a holistic rather than a reductionist notion of what a human being is, and it gives us the opportunity not just to talk about those things, but to see how they're all connected and how one change in one area can affect change in others.
And what did you learn from him?
I learned that we're all one system, and I learned that our way of thinking about human beings, the sort of standard philosophical view that there's the mind and that there's the body and that they sort of just touch on each other, is just wrong. That the mind and body are profoundly connected, and that we can affect changes in our brain, we can affect changes in our DNA. In fact, this myth that they tell us when we're younger that, well, you've only got a couple brain cells, and if you destroy them, you'll never get them back, you know, that's not true.
Made me scared of beer forever.
I was going to say, I'm not encouraging all sorts of substance use. That's a personal decision, right? But you can rebuild those brain cells. You can have healthier neurons and synaptic connections, and you can affect your DNA as well. Your lifestyle, your choices have profound effects on your physicality, which then have profound effects on your mental abilities and your overall psychological well-being. It's a system. It's a cycle. And if you get nothing else from his work, that's a key message.
Well, how about the impact of modern living? We're sitting, we're commuting, we're in temperature-controlled offices. How is that impacting our wellness?
Well, so here's a fun fact. Despite the fact that we talk about evolution all the time, human beings haven't evolved in the last 40,000 to 50,000 years. We have the same bodies as prehistoric human beings had. Now, they were hunter and gatherers. We are not, right? The most hunter-gathering I do is, you know, going to Target for something, right? So we have these bodies that are designed for these outdoor lives, these this pursuit of food, this sort of day-to-day search for sustenance and shelter and safety, and we don't have that anymore. So our bodies don't really understand how to exist in the world that we live in, right? Which is why, I mean, every North Dakotan knows that you have an extra 10 pounds in February than you do in September because you're not outside and you're consuming food and you're not engaging in the same way. When I first moved to North Dakota, someone said to me, the summers are so beautiful and the winters are so difficult that if in the summer you don't see your neighbor outside, you have to assume they're sick, right? Mm-hmm. And I get what this person was saying, because the summer in North Dakota is fundamentally different than the winter. Think about that as analogous to the prehistoric human being who's outside, who's active, who's thinking about how to acquire the next piece of meat, compared to the sedentary person who is in a climate controlled environment and walks from the office to the car to the home. Mm-hmm. The way your body is going to react is going to be fundamentally different, and your mood and your attitude and your level of happiness is going to change as well.
So then do you also get into the nutritional component of health? And people who are paying attention oftentimes will say, I just don't feel good when I eat, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da, and when I'm eating something that's really healthy, I just feel better.
We don't talk about that in the interview, although John spends a fair amount of time in Go Wild talking about sugar and other substances that create inflammation in the body. He talks about the fact that, and this was actually really interesting to me, that nutritionally, we need all sorts of grasses and other forms that we're not able to digest. And one of the reasons why human beings evolved to eat animals is that animals digest those nutrients. And then when we eat the meat, we get the nutrients. There is, however, a whole host of literature sort of revolving around this about the ideal nutrition and not. I think the important thing that you get out of John's book and you get out of the other literature that I've only dived into in the last year or so is if you pay attention to how the food makes you feel in the long term rather than the short term, you get a sense of how your body is responding properly or negatively, right? So I have a donut, I feel good for 10 minutes, and then I have a crash. Mm-hmm. But if I drink a green smoothie, which I actually have next to me, I feel good in 2 hours. That's about the body and the physiology, and then it affects my mood, right? There's mm-hmm. that ad campaign for, I forget what it is, Snickers or something, where someone is hangry, right? Where they're hungry and angry at the same time.
Happens to me all the time.
Yeah, that's a blood sugar dip. That's a obvious and direct evidence as to how our physiology affects our mood and how our attitude about eating healthy and exercising and doing other sorts of things can affect our physiology.
Sure. Well, we're always talking about the runner's high and these people who run a lot and they seem very happy all of the time. Maybe not when they're running, but right. But afterwards. And there's this release of endorphins there, or even I practice yoga, and oftentimes in the class, I'm breathing really, it's a labored breath for me because in some positions, you know, that's just not how we breathe normally, or you're collapsing one lung on purpose. But 2 hours, 4 hours later, I feel incredible. So the effects down the road.
That's right. And there's an interesting contrast if you look at the two examples you used, right? So the runner's high. One of the wonderful things about Spark, and he addresses this very explicitly, is that the runner's high is a sort of abstract thing that some runners get and some runners don't, and it's hard to measure and it's not very reliable. When he talks about this stuff, he talks about it on the cellular level. He talks about neurons and synaptic connections and biochemistry. And so he shows that exercise has profound effect on the brain in a way that isn't about an immediate emotion, but it's about overall, again, wellness. And that's connected to the stuff you're talking about with yoga. What's happening? Yoga actually means breathing, right? So what happens when you breathe? Your blood is circulating in the brain, and your brain activity is increasing over a long period of time, practicing mindfulness, practicing yogic meditation or other such things, it improves the synaptic connections. And so whereas a runner's high is sort of temporary, much like you would get right again from the donut, although probably healthier than the donut, the joy that comes from yoga comes from repetition and practice. And what ends up happening is you have a neuron that creates a connection, and the first time there's an electrical pulse between the neurons, that connection fades if you just do it once. But if you do it 100 times, 1,000 times, if you do it over 6 months, over a year, that connection becomes permanent. And that's what happens in yoga. What you're actually doing is creating permanent neural connections in the brain, because the brain is plastic. It can be molded. And so a runner's high is just a one-time event. But yoga is a lifestyle and has permanent positive effects on physiological and mental health.
Well, and it strikes me, and I got to listen to the back end of this recording here and there as it was happening. So stop me if I'm putting words into your mouth here, but it strikes me that a good chunk of your conversation can sort of be summed up in Western medicine is fantastic at a lot of things, but in some cases, we have put so much power and so much trust in Western medicine that we've taken it away from ourselves and our own ability to listen to what our bodies are saying.
I think that's right up to a point, right? Okay. Actually, interestingly, I had the same exact conversation with a friend a couple days ago. So on the one hand, Western medicine is very, very narrow, and we're at the tail end of a period – we'll see how long it lasts, of a sort of almost passiveness. Your kid has ADD, give him a pill. Mm-hmm. You're depressed, take a pill. You have social anxiety, take a pill. Now, there are times when medicine, and I have benefited from antidepressants myself, there's time when medicine is absolutely necessary, and I'm not bad-mouthing it at all. But the question is, does the patient become passive or active? Western medicine has become very bad at having active, responsible patients who are taking charge of their own healthcare. The problem is that when people hear that, what they tend to hear is, well, Eastern medicines are much better. The problem with the Eastern attitude is that it tends to dismiss the physical life. So in Hindu point of view and in Buddhism, suffering is an illusion, right? If you mm-hmm. if you reach enlightenment like the Buddha, when Siddhartha becomes the Buddha realizes that we are all one, and that our day-to-day life is meaningless in the face of eternity and our oneness. Now, I understand the power of that, and it's very important in a lot of respects. But to say to someone, your suffering isn't important, to say to someone, your pain is an illusion, that's at least as destructive as having too narrow a physiological point of view. And so what's really nice about our conversation is that it takes that mind perspective and it takes that body perspective, and it tries to mold the two. Can we take the best of the East and the best of the West and come up with something that is holistic rather than prioritizing either mind or body while negating the other side?
Yeah, we like to just have something fit into one box or the other.
That's right. And of course, John and I didn't talk about this East-West conversation. It's a tremendously important and sophisticated conversation. I'm really glad you brought it up. But it was an underpinning of the whole conversation, because sure, we're looking for, again, that holistic sense. And I think that the attraction of yoga and New Age philosophy, which has been very helpful for a lot of people, part of that attraction is the lack of alternatives. And I think all people around the globe should have the best of everything so that all people can be happy, healthy, and well.
The show is going to end on talking about the importance of group exercises and the social bonding benefits of people cheering on other people and exercising together. Tell us this story of this young woman climber.
Well, so one of the things that John discovered, and actually he learned this from physical education teachers in Illinois, is that our basic model of physical education is terrible because it's team sports, which means that most people are standing around doing nothing. They're not building their cardiac health, and they're competitive. Mm-hmm. So they built a kind of physical education on heart rate. And so he tells the story of a young woman in junior high school who's not particularly fit. She's just getting into physical education. She's engaged in a rock climb, and she gets stuck in the middle, and she's scared, and she's tired. She can't move. And one of the other students sees her and starts cheering for her, and then they all start cheering for her. And she moves up, and she finishes the rock climb. She succeeds, and then she comes down, and then she tells the PE teacher and then John, she says, "This is the first time anyone has ever cheered for me in my life." Mm-hmm. Now, who would have thought that physical education could be empowering, that gym class could be a place of collective support as opposed to conflict? That story alone is groundbreaking, and it makes me tear up a little bit because it's everything we want out of education, and it brings out the best in people, not the competitive, narrow, "I'm a star, look at me" attitude.
Well, as usual, it was a fascinating discussion, and you can hear it this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central on the radio network of Prairie Public. And I urge you also to listen to the podcast version a little bit longer, where you get into diseases of modern civilization and even a point where Professor Rady says that when he was a medical student, you never saw type 2 diabetes. Fascinating discussion. Jack Russell Weinstein, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And of course, you can get all the episodes, including the newest one, at whyradioshow.org, whyradioshow.org. Thanks, Ashley, so much.
Coming up next, Tom Ezern and Pioneer Mothers.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about President Jefferson's dinner parties.
Jefferson was famous for Virginia hospitality, which he carried with him wherever he went, including the White House, where he had two or three or even four small dinner parties during the course of every week.
He famously said, "I never considered a difference of opinion in politics, in religion, in philosophy as cause for withdrawing from a friend."
He chose the meals himself. He did some of the shopping for vegetables for the White House mess. He even set up the seating charts for these dinner parties, and in one instance, caused an international incident with a British ambassador.
While there was a political backdrop to Jefferson's dinners, he never made them political.
Jefferson was himself a very modest man, but he was not averse to using political theater when it advanced his ends.
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. How often do you read historical markers? Well, Tom Ezern certainly does. And then he levels up and reads books about historical markers. In this week's Plains Folk essay, he talks about pioneer mother monuments.
I'm writing this piece on Memorial Day, a day when many of us are attending to soldier monuments of one sort or another. We have some fine ones in North Dakota, from the Grand Army of the Republic monuments in Devil's Lake, Fargo, Lisbon, and Grand Forks, to the more recent and inventive ones like that stunning iron obelisk in Rutland. We walk up to such monuments and we figure we know what they mean. On one level we do, but do any of us really know what such monuments mean to those who fought or those who lost loved ones or to those who suffered some other destabilizing effect of war? All right, then, our pioneer monuments, depicting far-seeing explorers, honest plowmen, sturdy and long-suffering women. Those are straightforward, right? Well, think again. After reading the new book, Pioneer Mother Monuments, by Cynthia Culver Prescott, you will think again. As Prescott recounts, pioneer monuments, particularly pioneer women's monuments, appeared across the American West according to general eras and their values. The James Pick Pioneer Monument, dating from 1894 in San Francisco, was the model for the first generation of pioneer monuments. These depictions celebrated the March of White Civilization across the West. They were social Darwinist in posture. Indians were a dying race. Non-Anglo peoples had bit parts. And Anglo-American pioneers were lionized, triumphal. This was progress. Such monuments also exhibited desirable gender identities, as Prescott puts it. Until along came Sacagawea, as immortalized in 1905 by the feminist project of Portland Women's Sacagawea Statue Association. Exalted as the first pioneer mother to cross the Rocky Mountains and carry her baby into the Oregon country. In such a depiction, leadership was important, but so was carrying the baby, pomp. You could have it both ways. The resonant echo of the Portland depiction bore fruit in North Dakota, as women's clubs emplaced our own version of Sacagawea and pomp on the Capitol grounds. Further along in the 20th century, monument makers in an era of women's liberation deemed it important to deal with the sexuality and femininity of white women in what Prescott calls the Pioneer Mother Movement. Oil man E.W. Marland of Ponca City commissioned his famous Pioneer Woman statue by Bryant Baker. The Daughters of the American Revolution emplaced 12 Madonna of the Trail statues by August Leimbach in historic points across the continent. Sunbonnets were historic motifs, with their invocation of Catholic Madonna tropes by forming halos around the heads of pioneer mothers. Certain intentional additions to the model helped to mute the Catholic imagery and make the pioneer mothers of statuary more assertive and yet still womanly. For a pioneer woman to carry a Bible, a rifle, or both carried the message. Nina Farley Wishick of Ashley in 1927 commenced organizing within the North Dakota Federation of Club Women to get North Dakota on board with the Pioneer Mother Movement. Fundraising was slow, perhaps because Wishick insisted on a strong female figure in advance of public taste on the matter, and then funds lagged during the Great Depression. Businessmen took over the project and brought in the artist, Avard Fairbanks, who, instead of a pioneer woman, fashioned the Pioneer Family statue that was installed in front of the new state capitol in 1946. Here, the father figure is central, and the family huddles together. The North Dakota Pioneer Family Monument set the mold for a new generation of monuments suited to the Cold War era and its public emphasis on the strength and importance of the patriarchal nuclear family. Such tropes dominated the monument field until late in the 20th century, when the philosophical basis for monument making splintered, as did, we might observe historically, American consensus values. As for the artist, Avard Fairbanks, University of North Dakota President George Starcher liked him and his work so much, he brought him in from Utah and made him sculptor in residence at UND. This went badly. The sculptor's values were out of place in the university's art department, and according to Prescott, Fairbanks fled his UND studio under cover of darkness. The author of Pioneer Mother Monuments is Associate Professor of History at the University of North Dakota. Its publisher is University of Oklahoma Press.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, Madeline reviews Rocket Man, and we have our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson. Now, it's time for today's news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota lawmakers say they're optimistic about the plans to replace the state's troubled MNLARS system. MNLARS is the state's vehicle licensing system. The legislature allocated $53 million to hire a private vendor and purchase a new software package. DFL Representative Frank Hornstein chairs the House Transportation Committee. He said the replacement will help the state turn a corner, both technologically and politically.
We have a governor that's engaged. We have Democrats and Republicans that are united behind this plan. which is really coming out of the executive branch. So I think we're now on a path to get the politics out of this.
Senate Transportation Committee Chairman Scott Newman, a Republican, says he's looking forward to the end of what he called the Midlar's mess. The new software should be ready to go by the year 2020. Two is better than none. The Fargo Horse Park has been granted two race weekends next month by the State Racing Commission. Late last year, the Racing Commission approved four race weekends for the Fargo track. Horse Race North Dakota, the nonprofit volunteer organization that runs the track, asked that number to be cut to three weekends of racing because of complications out of their control. Instead, the racing committee briefly revoked the track's license a week ago because of questions about Susan Bala, who held positions at the horse park. Bala stepped down this week, and that allowed the track to once again apply for race dates. Racing Commission Executive Director Jack Schultz says despite fewer races, the track should be financially in the black.
I think that it allows them to have purses that are sufficient to attract, you know, good quality horses to race their two weekends. And, so I think that's a positive.
The horse park races are set for July 19th and 20th and July 27th and 28th. Jay Alsop, president of Horse Race North Dakota, says the board passed a unanimous vote of support for Bala and is confident the issues can be resolved with the Racing Commission. And it's Water Safety Day in Fargo through the YMCA of Cass and Clay Counties, and the lessons learned here can help all residents of North Dakota. Here's more from Prairie Public's Joshua Hinkemeyer.
Summer is here, which means many families and their children will be swimming in the water in order to avoid the hot temperatures. The YMCA of Cass and Clay Counties are holding a Water Safety Day event today. The pools in the area will have activities that teach kids to stay safe while having fun in the water. Maxwell Oman, aquatics coordinator at the Y, says that they want to reinforce safety around pools and the lakes. He says participants will learn how to call for help and basic swimming skills. Oman says that it is important for parents to be informed, and education is the key. Life jackets are a popular safety device, and Oman says that families must understand information and guidelines about life jackets.
So when it comes to life jackets, Coast Guard approved is always the way to go. We want to make sure it fits nice and snug. It's not too big, not too loose. We also want to make sure that just parents are always watching their kids. The lifeguards are always there to help out when things don't go as planned, but parents watching their kids is really the number one way to keep kids safe.
Oman says that water safety is important everywhere where water is present, whether it is lakes, pools, or at a home. Kids will be in the water as summer gets hotter, and preparing them for anything will keep them safe. Reporting from Prairie Public, I'm Joshua Hinkemeyer.
And for Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The 29th Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival will be held Friday and Saturday, June 14th and 15th at the Cross Ranch State Park near Washburn. Bands are coming from Alabama, Ohio, Minnesota, and North Dakota, and hosted by Washburn's very own Cottonwood. 16 and under are free, there is great camping and late-night jamming, and you can learn a bluegrass song at the workshop on Saturday. More information online at cottonwoodbluegrass.com or by phone at 701-794-3731.
Is it true that I've lost you? Am I not?
Well, the old teletype machine means it's time to talk to our news hound, news director Dave Thompson, who joins us once a week to talk about this week's headlines. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Glad to, Ashley.
We had a presidential hopeful make a stop in the state, Senator
right.
Amy Klobuchar.
Made a stop in Fargo at Atomic Coffee, which is not too far from Prairie Public's Fargo location. And it was a rally, and she was pressed for time because she had some other things to do, so we didn't get a chance to ask very many questions. But she gave her stump speech and made a couple of references to Fargo and a couple of references to farming, the farming economy, and was on to Duluth.
Well, the North Dakota Senate race of 2016 garnered a lot of national attention. It was seen as a battleground state for that Senate race. Do we think that the 2020 election that North Dakota will have anywhere near that same sort of national focus?
Only because, you know, there is a governor's race right there. And, of course, mm-hmm. there's a House race. You know, there could be some real interest to see what happens in that governor's race.
Okay. And then going back to Senator Klobuchar, did she talk at all about, you know, there's still something like two dozen Democratic people who are hopeful for the official nomination?
She didn't really directly talk about that, but there are a lot of candidates. And I am actually expecting some of them to make some rounds in North Dakota.
Okay. And you said that farming was among a major topic.
Of course, because farms are being impacted by some of the tariff things. And she did comment about that.
Mm-hmm. Does she have a lot of specific information as it might apply to North Dakota people and businesses?
Not that much specific yet, but, you know, she'll learn. Sure. You know, she's been talking with former Senator Heidi Heitkamp, who has been letting her know some about the issues and the issues that farmers are facing. So she'll have some of that, I think.
Minot State is launching a major in medicinal plant chemistry.
Right, through the chemistry department.
Okay, the plant that gets all the attention when we talk about medicinal plants is marijuana. I assume
right.
That's going to be a major course of study.
Well, it is, as the industry for medical marijuana is just really getting started now. The idea is that there's going to be a demand as this industry grows for chemists who can separate, you know, the hallucinogens out of marijuana and keep some of the other products that are more beneficial, because it's the THC that is the hallucinogen, but there are other products within marijuana that could have some medical use.
Do you have any idea how long this project has been in the works?
I believe it's fairly recently, but I think it's demand that or response to demand. The colleges and universities are really trying to come up with a quick turnaround on demand. Minot State saw an opportunity, was approached by it, and went for it.
Do we have a sense, will this be sort of like a local supply for things like medical marijuana, which is legal in the state of Minnesota and in several other states as well?
There will be local supplies, of course. We know we've got a couple of grow centers that are going to be established, and the grow centers will be looking for some of these chemists to help them out too. And if you can, you know, get that stuff so the THC is out, it could make things like edible marijuana a little bit more palatable.
We're going to be visiting with Dr. Heth at Minot State University about this program next week, so do tune in for that. But I'll ask you, Dave, one more question. There are hundreds of plants that have a lot of medicinal properties.
Right.
Does this major go into other plants?
That's what I understand it. It will go into other plants. But, of course,
okay.
Medicinal marijuana, you know, medicinal cannabis, mm-hmm. is the real focus right now, because there's a lot of spotlight on it.
Sure. Other news in the state, Aldevron planning a major expansion here. So this is a company that is a biotech firm. There's about 300 people employed there. And
right.
We're going to more than triple that.
We are. It's going to be more than 1,000 people, 180,000 plus more square feet of labs and space and product development areas. And remember, this started basically, as the founder said, in a closet, because it was started out of NDSU research. They started this, and they've grown it from basic bare beginnings, just a couple of people. Now we're talking about 1,000 people.
And what's behind this push for the expansion?
Well, again, it's demand. As we're seeing more and more demand for these medicinal substances, there's a lot of demand for that, and you're seeing ads for herbal things and for other cures and opportunities to treat some things. And in talking to the Aldevron people, they're saying, we are working on actual cures of diseases. So, you know, you're using, you know, more of a green type thing that's grown instead of something that's synthesized.
And so, then there also is a focus there on genetic medicine as well.
That's correct, yes. And that I think is extremely interesting. But, you know, there is a bit of controversy over things like gene splicing and you know, those things are still in the research stage, so it's taking some while.
It's going to be interesting.
It is.
When do they think that this will be all up and running? 189,000 square feet, no small amount.
Well, they were sure talking about maybe late 2020, maybe early 2021.
Okay. West Fargo Public School has its first all-electric school bus.
Interesting. And really, they said, and it looks like a bus. But if you go by an electric school bus and you try to hear the motor start, you don't,
right,
because there's no starting sound. Also, they're thinking that this might be a way to, you know, just green things up, and we'll see. It's an experiment. And, of course, electricity, we're heading in that direction too. So, you know, it means use of more electricity, and North Dakota is a net exporter of electricity. So there's product available. So it could very well work very well, in especially in cities like West Fargo and Fargo.
Is the bus a plug-in bus?
I believe it is.
Okay. So curious about the infrastructure here, because a lot of electric cars are able to work well on the East and West Coast because there is a lot of infrastructure there for plugging in the cars. How is that infrastructure in the state?
It's starting to evolve. We're seeing more efforts to put infrastructure in. For example, downtown Fargo, there are places where you can plug cars in. And also there's thought now, if electric cars really catch on in North Dakota, we might have charging stations at population centers along the interstates and along Highway 2.
Do we know how much this bus costs?
I do not know at this point. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, I know buses are expensive. And
they are.
And schools don't exactly have a bunch of extra money.
Exactly. That's right.
All right. The Department of Environmental Quality is taking over a program known as Quad O or Quad Zero.
I had to laugh because if you think Quad O, you think that there are a lot of acronyms in these kind of things. But Quad O refers to some section of a code, and basically it talks about air quality, you know, that's more localized. Say you're drilling for oil and there's some air quality issues there. And the EPA's got primacy on that one, but the DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, has said, let's let us do this and let's do a proactive thing to prevent these companies from getting in trouble for these localized air quality issues.
So what are they going to be doing?
They're going to be sending inspectors out. They're going to be working with industry on the front end, and they're not giving up any, you know, enforcement authority, but they're just trying to be a little bit more proactive to stop things before they really do get started.
Sure. Do they have any powers of, like, fining?
They do, and that's okay. That's based on what is both in federal code and also in state code.
Okay. The state MMIS system is now certified, the Medicaid Management Information System.
It has
taken 10 years and millions of dollars.
It has. It's taken a lot of money because they had to improve it from a mainframe-based system to now modern computers. It took a lot longer than they expected. They had a number of vendors come in and work with the state. And it used to be kind of a little bit of a joke because they knew they had to do it. They knew they had to upgrade because they would get reimbursement if they upgraded. But it took a long time to upgrade, so there was kind of a laugh every time they would bring it up in one of the hearings in the legislature. And it was good-natured because everybody knew we had to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But you think about a Medicare and Medicaid system that not only takes care of what the clients want, but also what the providers want and manages reimbursement to clients, reimbursement to providers. That's a fairly complicated system with a lot of elements to it.
Yeah, a lot of moving parts there.
Absolutely.
So is the claim that this is more efficient or
much
just
more efficient?
Okay.
Much more efficient and much more in terms of inputting information into it and also exporting information out.
Okay. We've got a minute left here. The North Dakota Housing Finance Agency Executive Director Jolene Klein is retiring. She's been with the agency 34 years, the last few years since 2013, serving as the Executive Director.
And she's getting a lot of accolades from her bosses at the Industrial Commission for doing good work in terms of getting people into homes, the first-time home buyer program, and also trying to provide avenues for more affordable housing. That became very important as the Bakken population exploded.
Just quickly here, 30 seconds left. Why is the Housing Finance Agency under the Industrial Commission?
Because it was the Industrial Commission who created it. And the Industrial Commission has the authority to underwrite bonds that are issued. Now, bonds help, you know, provide the front-end money for the first-time homebuyer program.
Okay, well, she's going to be enjoying some time as a grandmother, so congratulations.
Absolutely.
Jolene. Thanks, Dave. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Coming up next, Madeline reviews Rocket Man.
The This week, the true story behind the famous mystery meat inside a bun.
What I really want to know is who actually invented the word hot dog.
And so that's always been a mystery to me. Where did the phrase cold turkey come from?
This question came to mind, and I thought you two would be the perfect people to ask.
Join us this week on Away with Words.
It was one of those cases of knowing just enough to be dangerous.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Well, there's the fanfare. It's time to go to the movies with a movie maven, Matt O'Lean. Matt, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Ashley.
And you have gone to go see a film about a man whose musical legacy has certainly impacted millions and will for many years. This is a new movie about Sir Elton John.
Yeah, Rocket Man it's called, and it's directed by Dexter Fletcher, who also took over directing duties on Bohemian Rhapsody when Bryan Singer was let go. Now, that's a lot of backstory there. Bryan Singer has been accused of many, many sexual things in Hollywood. So he was replaced and basically had nothing to do with that awards run that Rhapsody had. So Dexter Fletcher knows how to direct a film about a band. And this is a much different film, though, about Elton John. I think it's a better film than Bohemian Rhapsody. This film is much darker. It's an R rating. It delves into Elton John's drug addictions, alcohol addictions in the 70s and 80s, which he eventually overcame. Where Bohemian, as you remember, Ashley, was a PG-13. It was kind of the film that Queen's band members wanted for the fans, a little more of a sanitized view of Freddie Mercury's life. This is more the warts and all view of Elton John's life, okay? So that's going to probably keep the box office down. Even though it debuted at $25 million, which is solid, it will never do the box office that Bohemian did worldwide, which really caught fire. But I think it's a better film for a couple reasons. It's just better done. It doesn't have all the timeline problems that Bohemian Rhapsody had, kind of these amateurish scenes that they had in Bohemian Rhapsody, even though the fans loved it. This has some remarkable music numbers. So occasionally in the film, what happens, Ashley, is all of a sudden there'll be a number, like Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting. And it'll be this number that happens in the middle of dialogue, and it kind of furthers the story as to what's going on with his life at the time. And these are really well-done numbers. I mean, these are show-stopping, musical-type numbers with Taron Egerton, of course, doing the singing and playing Elton John. His singing is serviceable as Elton John. He does not have the vocal range of Elton John, but he does his own singing. Rami Malek did not in Bohemian Rhapsody. Let me make that comparison. So I give Edgerton a lot of credit for this performance as Elton John. He really pulls it off. At sometimes I feel Edgerton's acting is a little effortful. You see the effort going in, but overall I liked his performance. So for the most part, I like this film. It's much more cinematic. It's much more inventive. You actually have musical numbers that look like you're watching a musical that further along Elton John's story. Where the film finally kind of drags to a halt for me, however, is once we get past all of the built up to success, it kind of turns into your run-of-the-mill, sex and drugs, rock and roll biopic. And we've seen that before. And certainly this is what happened in his life. But the last 25, 30 minutes of the film feels a little sloggish. Like, that's what we're into. Here we go. And then the recovery. I want to also credit, however, Fletcher for having a framing device as flashbacks. We first see Elton John in recovery at a rehab center. And he's talking to a group about his life. And we get all these flashbacks to him as a child, unloved by his mother and father. His grandmother loved him, though, and she really pushed his musical genius. So that's a real great framing device that really carries us through the film. That was really inventive. You don't see things like that in Bohemian Rhapsody. So it's a much more inventive film. I liked it for the most part. I want to also credit Jamie Bell, a wonderful actor who plays Bernie Taupin. As you know, that is Elton John's lyricist, and that's how they came together, where Bernie Taupin wrote these lyrics. Elton John put music together. Elton John always struggled with lyric writing, which really makes what Lennon and McCartney did even that more amazing. They did lyrics and music, but it's a great teamwork they have. There's a phenomenal scene, Ashley, where he puts music to Bernie's lyrics to Your Song. And that's that kind of moment where he hears the music to those words. And that's a great scene. That really comes off well. I would have liked one more scene, though, on how Bernie Taupin came up with these lyrics. What was his inspiration for writing Goodbye Yellow Brick Road and Daniel and all these songs? We never really get that. But we do get Elton John's musical genius. Also, I want to mention a really good performance by Richard Madden as Elton John's sort of shady agent and manager, John Reed, and he becomes Elton John's lover when he represents him. Interestingly enough, Ashley, John Reed also appeared in Bohemian Rhapsody. He was Queen's manager for 3 years. So, and this is interesting, Game of Thrones fans, listen, Aidan Gillen played John Reed in Bohemian Rhapsody. He was Lord Peter Baelish in Game of Thrones. Well, Richard Madden was Robb Stark in Game of Thrones, and he plays John Reed here. So apparently only Game of Thrones actors, these two must have had a laugh over this. They were rivals in Game of Thrones, of course, but playing the same man. So overall, I liked it. I think it's a better film than Bohemian Rhapsody. It won't do the box office business, but look for Taron Egerton to maybe get some a push toward an Oscar nomination for lead actor.
And maybe we'll see Sir Elton John and being the one ending up on the Iron Throne. No, probably not. Does it get into Elton John's activism? He is quite an activist.
No. This covers his early life through about 1990 when he got sober. So it's really those formative years with Bernie Taupin when they're writing hit after hit after hit. But he got lost in drugs and of course, this film doesn't tiptoe around Elton John's homosexuality like Bohemian did. Mm-hmm. It gets into it. John Reed becomes his real first lover, and they have a lot of problems as manager-lover. That's a bad combination to have, probably. It doesn't really get into that. It's mostly about his career, his genius, his struggles with his parents, wanting to be loved by his father, who's very unemotional.
And Elton John was an advisor on this
yes,
film, right?
Yes, he was. And he wanted the R rating. He wanted the warts and all version, whereas Queen did not on Bohemian Rhapsody, which makes another interesting thing to talk about, Ashley, and that's this. What makes a successful movie? And is a successful movie a movie that makes a lot of money but isn't real maybe artistically well done like Bohemian? Or is a successful movie a film that's better? I think it's better made. It's more cinematic like Rocketman, but it won't make the money of Bohemian. That's one of those balancing acts in the movie industry. The number of films that have achieved that double, they hit something with the public fancy, and yet they're artistic masterpieces. That's a small group, you know, Godfather, Bonnie and Clyde, Schindler's List, something that makes a lot of money but is generally regarded as a great film. So that's what you have here. I think Rocketman will do good business, but it won't do the business of Bohemian because Elton John's still alive. Freddie Mercury died young and tragic, and I think that drives a box office story.
Sure.
But overall, I would say if you like Elton John's music, go to this. You might not like some of how he comes off in the film, especially later in the film, but that's what he wanted. So,
well, speaking of Elton John, mm-hmm. and we always try to get you with some Oscar trivia, so I couldn't not have an Elton John-themed Oscar question. So 1994 films, 95 Oscars. The music category.
Lion King.
Okay.
I'm sure that's what you're driving at here.
Yep, pretty much. Can you give me the winner and who else was in it? And I'll give you a hint. Elton John's in it three times.
So I think he and Tim Rice, his mm-hmm. lyricist, not Bernie Taupin on that, had three songs nominated in the song category, right, Ashley?
They did.
Hakuna Matata,
mm-hmm.
Can You Feel the Love Tonight?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
It's a
Circle of Life.
Yep.
You want to know the winner, don't you?
I do.
I think it was Can You Feel the
Can
Love Tonight.
Can You Feel the Love Tonight?
Yes.
You want to round out the other two nominees? They're not from The Lion King.
No, I know they're not. 94 songs. Wow.
Yeah, well,
let's
can't
see.
Make them all easy.
Nothing from Shawshank and Pulp Fiction. I'm just joking there.
Junior and the Paper.
I don't remember the songs.
Well, we got Look What Love Has Done and Make Up Your Mind.
Okay, two songs nobody remembers.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Taj Mahal to the Fargo Theater June 18th and to the Bel Mayhus Auditorium in Bismarck June 19th.
Oh.
Tickets are available now at jadepresents.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 7th. About this time in 1949, North Dakotans were learning that a man doing time for forgery in Michigan had confessed to killing two people in North Dakota. One of his victims was shot in a beauty salon in Jamestown, and the other was a man named James Woods. In his confession, 29-year-old John Crockard said he and Woods used to run drugs into North Dakota from Canada and had even robbed a bank. He said Woods had gotten friendly with a Jamestown hairdresser named Margaret Roselier. Crockard became concerned when Woods told Roselier about the bank robbery and the narcotics. He went into a lavatory and injected drugs while deciding what to do. He then went to the beauty parlor, saying he planned to take her along with them, but instead shot her. Crockard said he was too hopped up to remember whether he used his own .32 or Woods' .38. When asked how many shots he fired, he answered, "I don't know. I was excited. It could have been 60 or it could have been one." He said he found his way back to the car and left town with Woods. He gave Woods some drops that knocked him out, then stopped outside Jamestown where he stabbed Woods to death. He said he buried Woods, the guns, and the knife in a roadbed that was about to be paved. In Fargo, Crockard checked into a hotel and overheard some railroad men discussing the Jamestown murder of Roselier. He sold the car, chose a name from the phone book, and started forging checks. He next traveled to Bismarck, where he said he tried to get caught for the forgeries, and he was. After serving time in North Dakota, he was handed over to Michigan authorities. Crockard confessed to all this in 1949. He said he had found the Lord. It was on this date that Stutzman County officials interviewed him and concluded that Crockard made it all up, since almost nothing checked out. Crockard couldn't remember Margaret Roselier's name, the brand of gun, or the kind of car he drove, nor could he account for where or when he sold the car. When asked what Woods looked like, he said, "I think he had dark hair and thin, long arms." The detectives were fans of Pulp Fiction, and in a surprising twist, they discovered a recent Dick Tracy story that may have inspired Crockard's fantasy. The bad guys had to get rid of a dead body, and they chose a roadbed ready for the cement. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, time for your lawn and garden questions. Horticulturist Ron Smith will be live in studio, so get your questions to us early via email, mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, or get ready to call us Monday. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.